accession number 18336, Reel 2.
Jim Wills, Reel 2. You were just telling me about going in the Warwick Castle.
Warwick Castle, and then, eventually we sailed as a very big convoy. And, of course, the speed of the convoy is the speed of the slowest ship. And it took us nearly 5 to 6 weeks to get to Freetown, where we were our first port of call. And we must have gone right up around the north of around the Arctic somewhere to get there. Anyway,
what were conditions like on the voyage?
On the voyage, except for submarine warnings, they called you, you know, you had to wear your life jacket at all times. And you had your places to go to for boat drills. It was very pleasant on the Warwick Castle, but we come to the extreme when we got to Freetown, which we knew were somewhere out of the tropics with a smell that came out from the shore. And we had to go on an old trooper, real old ship trooper, and we were about 5 decks below. So we all refused to sleep down there, you know, because torpedoes. And we slept on deck, much against orders, but we did it. And it was only about 4 days, I think, sailing from there around to Takoradi, where we disembarked. And the RAF had commandeered the local school there, and built a series of wooden huts, complete with mosquito netting all the way around them, and verandas, and so you had double doors you had to go through. And we were the first draft that had managed to get through for some while. We're number 20 draft. We had to work 7 days a week in the tropics, which wasn't very pleasant. Building aircraft that were too small to fly direct from England or America to the Middle East. They came to Takoradi either as deck cargo in packing cases, fuselage in one and wings in another, and or else they came on the carriers, and we built them on the carriers, and then flew into our place for desert equipment, for filters, etc. But the working at working conditions were very poor.
In what way?
Well, one of my jobs as a airframe fitter was connecting up all the control wires right through the fuselage. We would have to go right down the inside the fuselage in the tropics. It was with a soldering iron, soldering up the joint. And there's nothing to get in there and find a hornet's nest or something like that. We'd put you off for a while until it's been sprayed out. But,
What kind of aircraft were these?
This was a Glen Martin Maryland. It was a twin-engine light bomber. The only time I've ever seen it mentioned in any books, war books or war stories, they had a squadron of them at Malta, because anyway, the aircraft didn't last very long. at Malta. No. They got shot down.
So you didn't have a variety of aircraft?
Oh, yes. There was, beside the Glenmard in Maryland, which I worked on, there was another hangar doing Blenheims, another hangar on Hurricanes, and what was the other one? Oh, there's we also had aircraft that should have been sent to the French Air Force, but the French Air Force had capitulated by then, so they came to us. Mohawks, Tomahawks, and aircraft such as that. And they were being built there. But all the instructions were in French. And everything seemed to work reverse to what the ours did somehow.
What did you think to the Glen Martin, Maryland?
It was a lovely looking thing when it was finished, but it seemed so long. As I say, I've only ever seen them mentioned once, but the idea from our place was they'd fly up to Libya in easy stages. We had prairie posts all the way up to Libya. But the pilots used to say in the end they didn't need any maps. They could just fly by the crashes.
Why were there so many crashes?
Well, just heat conditions and things like that, I suppose. And German, the Luftwaffe were very active at the time.
What were the main problems in doing your job, apart from encountering hornet's nests?
Oh, the main problem was getting in and out there. You know, at times it was so hot that you were more or less, well, not dehydrated, but somebody had to help you get out, pull you out, sort of business. You'd be working like this, you know, and. It's not very big inside. Of course, we're all very much thinner then in those days than we are now. Because what with malaria? Malaria was a very common thing. Once you had it, it seemed to strike about once a month.
Did you get malaria?
Oh, yes. And it was I had about three times, I think. And it's about 9 days you don't know much about in your life. You're in a hospital, in the sick bay, and you're either sweating in 1 minute and freezing the next, you know. But, of course, they were treating it well.
Sounds like a horrible experience.
Oh, it is. Malaria, terrible. I mean, the problem, and we had a tablet, a quinine tablet, which... had to be taken every day, and the orderly sergeant, it was his duty in the airman's mess to stand at the serving hatch, make sure that everybody took a quinine tablet.
Had you failed to take yours?
No. If you fail to take them, that's when your trouble started, because the yellow fever and things like that came in.
So how did you catch it if you were taking the quinine?
Oh, you get bitten by the mosquitoes. They overrode.
Were there many mosquitoes?
Oh yeah, we have mosquito netting over the beds, and as I say, we had two doors to come in, each with mosquito nets, netting. You know, the metal. Yeah.
So, was it a miserable time for you in Takoradi?
It wasn't miserable, because we knew we couldn't do much about it. We had to make the best of it. But it came as quite a surprise when we came home, because our draft, the senior draft, had been, this was after 18 months. Had been told we were going to be moved. So we had clearance jets. I don't know if you understand. In the service, each department you had to get it signed. There you didn't know anything. You didn't know anything on broken crockery or anything. We had a clearance jet signed, and to go to South Africa for 3 years, but they didn't. They wouldn't have us because of the. They said we were drug. We were carrying a disease. So then it was proposed the Middle East, and they didn't want us. We were outcasts. So, surprise, surprise! There was a lovely ship in the harbor. You could see her, the Batory, she was called, the Polish liner. And they came around. You report to the dockside at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, and or such and such, and we came home on the Batory.
You also told me earlier off the record that you felt that your skin problems nowadays are something to do with being in the Gold Coast.
Oh, yes. Oh, I do. I applied the war pensions, must be 5 years ago. And they upheld me as regards, the doctors did, as regards to skin cancers. They gave me a one-off payment.
Where do you get the skin cancers?
Oh, I got one here now. And
on your chest?
I get
your
them
ribs.
All over the place, on the back. Just the spot where you can't scratch, where it itches, you know. They itch quite a lot. I have one here, I have one cut out there.
On your head?
And I have one cut out there.
On your hand?
Yeah.
So have you had a lot?
Well, I'm hoping the doctor will do this one now. I had one on my ear last. Oh, and he burnt that off.
So did you mix much with the local population in Takoradi?
No, there was no mixing. There was no fraternization. Well, besides, I never went to anywhere. Oh, the only place we did go where we mixed with them was the local cinema. I don't know if you saw the picture in there. The tickets were a penny, twopence, and fourpence. Oh, there you are.
And you mixed with the local people there?
Well, you had to. You didn't mix with them. They sat next to you, that was it. But we also found there was a class of the local people who thought they were well above us. We were visitors. We were strangers to their land. But the poorer types. No, everything seemed to be in reverse there.
How do you mean?
Well, for example, poor a funeral, they hire a coffin from the village, take the coffin to the cemetery, tip the body out, and then they'd be dancing all the way around the grave, you know. And a wedding was a serious matter, because you had to give the bride's father so many sheep or so many horned cattle. You're getting fed up with my writing. Well, then, when we came back from there, we came back to Gorick in Scotland. We got on the train, and all I can remember after that was that we landed at Crewe, and we spent the whole night on Crewe station. Nothing, nowhere to sit, nowhere to lie down. No, everything was shut up. Well, there's nothing there. And we'd just come back from the tropics, and we were all muddled up in March, bundled up wearing overcoats right up around your eyes you could.
Had England changed much by the time you got back?
Well, I hadn't noticed a lot because I only going through London, that was the only place that I'd been or seen any damage. We had a disembarkation leave then, and then after that I was posted to Manston in Kent again, once again. And that was quite an experience with 174 Squadron. I was still in LAC, and I hadn't been. Well, I was posted right back in March. In April the 1st, I was made up the corporal, and straight away.
Was there much war-like activity at Manston?
Oh, Manston had a very bad time. It was still a grass runways, but all the hangars and housing accommodation that I'd known previously had all disappeared. Actually, I lived in with about half a dozen more in one of the married quarters, just outside the camp. That was the only accommodation we could, there was. All the rest had been badly bombed. But then we set up a squadron there, 174 Squadron, and we were on the servicing echelon for that squadron was 3082, which I became a member of. And then...
what kind of aircraft were you dealing
with? We were doing hurricane bombers and fighters. They used to nip across the channel and shoot other railway engines and things like that.
Were they badly damaged?
Quite a lot were badly damaged, yes. And this is where you get your experience of... in those days, I mean, whereas the Americans went around with a chainsaw and chopped everything up, we had to salvage every nut and bolt in case of a use again. And it came in very often that you had to do that, you know. You had a crashed aircraft, but anything that was any good on it, you took off and put it in store. And I thoroughly enjoyed my time there, 174 Squadron.
Did the enemy attack Manston whilst you were there?
Only once or twice at night. But
with bombs or strafing?
Oh, bombs. Bombs, but they either hit the runways, they never hit any personnel that I know of.
Did they put the drone out of action?
Oh, no, because you've got the engineers that come along with the bulldozers and fill in the craters.
So the attacks were ineffective?
Yeah, and as regards to Germans, yeah. But...
could the German artillery hit Manston?
Oh, yes, they could. Because they had this big gun on the railway line at what they used to call it.
Near Calais?
Near Calais, yeah.
Did the artillery do much damage?
No, I don't think so. No. from Manston.
Why did you enjoy it at Manston?
Because I had plenty of work. I thrived on doing these jobs. You know, doing a big repair. Bigger the repair, the better I liked it, the better. And I did a lot of skin repairs. A lot of the hurricane was fabric cover. You could dope that and patch, put a fabric patch on that easy enough. The wear was metal, and you had to have a face-to-face or a skin finish, you know. You had to do an inner plate and an outer plate to fulfill it. But anyway, we moved on then to...
Just before you move on, did you have much contact with the air crews at Manston?
Not a lot. We knew one or two, but it didn't pay to get to know them because we lost so many. You didn't get too familiar with them because you respected their rank and their also, but we'd learned that to get friendly with someone and then come back at night and there's an empty space, that it paid not to get too friendly.
Were the local population suffering much in East Kent?
I couldn't answer that one, really. Because Manston, as you know, is halfway between Margate and Ramsgate. It was quite a popular seaside, and all the Londoners come down there the weekend sort of business. And they did. And then there used to be the hop picking, of course, over in that way.
Was that still going on?
Oh, yes, yeah. Went on to fairly recently, I think, in fact. Yeah. Excuse me a minute, will I?
You left Manston in 43, you said. Where did you go then?
'43, that's when 2nd Technical Air Force became more or less in its infancy, and we built that up. The Technical Air Force was such that we had no permanent buildings, no permanent anything. Anything we had, such as a hangar, had to be transported by on a lorry. There is no place. Because they were practicing the system, whereas the Army would take so and so many miles up ahead, and there'd be four wings of aircraft, and they'd leapfrog. As the Army moved forward, so the rear one would come through, and then the next. And we did this all around the south of England. Westhampton, Tangmere, places like that, and Lydd. And we were at Lydd, and quite a coincidence, a friend of mine from the same village as I was brought up in, he joined the boys' service and was a sergeant, and I was still a corporal. And he applied and was granted training for engineering officer. And so there was a vacancy for a sergeant, and I was made up 12 months after being made corporal.
And can you tell me about the object of the 2nd Tactical Air Force?
The object was so they could be right behind the Army, right at the front line all the time.
What kind of preparations did you make for D-Day?
Oh, D-Day, we were at a place called Holmsley South in the New Forest. And there, of course, the invasion, it was about D plus six, and we knew it would be, you know, wouldn't be very long before we were on the move. So as soon as the army had got this, captured enough space in Normandy at Camilly-le-Fresnes, our wing took over there. Now, so as not to have a complete loss, half of the ground crew went by boat, and the other half flew in Dakotas. I was one of the ones that went on the Dakotas. And we took off at first light in the morning. We were flying Typhoons then, and the Typhoons were our escorts. And the engineers had built this runway in a cornfield. And as the planes landed, so a great cloud of dust came up, and the Germans were down the other end firing. So the one in front of us, they were landing very quick, as soon as they possibly could. One in front of us landed and pulled up a bit quick, and we landed and went into the back of it and smashed up two Dakotas. And at the same time, Jerry had our range, and he was the splinters were coming through the aircraft. So we all piled out and spent the biggest part of that day in a ditch up there in water, out of the sight, out of the way. And Jerry was just down the other end, so until our planes could come round and strafe him, we were at their mercy. But
anybody hit?
There was one or two minor ailments, but when we settled down in Normandy on B-35, the dust came up every time, and then after a while they rumbled to it and fitted air filters in front of the engine, because apparently some of the finest carborundum dust in the world is found in Normandy, and that would have been going in, being sucked into the aircraft and seizing the engine. So, and there was another nasty fault with the Typhoon when it came out first. It was, they'd take off and the tailplane would drop off. And the pilot, he had no chance. So in the end, they riveted plates all the way around